The Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices and Policy is called to order. We have a quorum. Representative Lunan, did you get a chance to review the minutes?
I actually have, and I would like to move the minutes.
Motion is made to move the minutes. Is there any discussion? No discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. On to our first bill, House File 1185. Representative Scott, before you start, Madam Chair, I would like to note that we are under a little bit of a time crunch. The deadline week is approaching, and for this bill, we're going to allocate 1 hour. So I'm going to ask that comments be brief and to the point of the bill. With that, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an A1 amendment I'd like to move.
Okay. Does everyone have a copy of the amendment? Okay, yes. House File 1185 is moved before the committee. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Representative Scott, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And where is this bill going next?
This bill is going to Government Operations and Elections Policy.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make members aware of the next stop of the bill. Members, a few weeks ago, we heard from the Records Disposition Panel, and if you missed that committee, you missed an enlightening conversation about government record retention in Minnesota. And one of the first things I'd like to do, I know you have a full packet this morning, but if you pull out this sheet of paper here, looks like this, it tells about the duties or the role of the Minnesota Historical Society on the Dispositions Panel, and then underneath that, it refers to the definition of state archives. And that term means those records preserved or appropriate for preservation as evidence of the organization, functions, policies, decisions, procedures, operations, or other activities of government. And then it goes on to tell about the value of those documents. The current retention period for correspondence in the panel's mostly decades-old retention schedule is 3 years. In this age of technology, government entities are trying to keep up with changes in operations that this technology brings. In House File 1185, we are creating a definition of correspondence so that it captures written and electronic text-based communications and is in keeping with the definition of state archives. Indeed, the legislature needs to address this issue. Currently, there's a hodgepodge of government retention policy in relation to electronic correspondence. And there needs to be uniformity so that no entity has to guess or simply choose what works best for them. I know we all care about government accountability and transparency. Obviously, neither is possible if records are destroyed after a short amount of time. Next, I'd like to draw your attention to page 4 of the bill. And if you look at subdivision 7 of page 4 of the bill, as you can see, it is government's responsibility in the Records Management Statute to, quote, establish and maintain an active continuing program for the economical and efficient management of the records of each agency. This has been the law since 1974. The Data Practices Act has been law since 1979. So these transparency and accountability laws have been in place for 40 years. So for over 40 years, government has been tasked with managing data and providing government data when requested. Whether that information is in paper form or electronic, the public indeed does have a right to access it, and it is the duty of the government to provide it. One of the concerns government entities have is storage. And you know that technological advancements have driven down the cost of storage. Now, I brought my props here this morning, so your typical banker's box is how they used to have to store data. And I tried to do a little bit of research online, and I found one analogy that said 8 of these banker's boxes, each holding 2,750 pages, is the equivalent to about 1 gigabyte of data. Now, governments used to have to store these in their basement, and sometimes they had to rent space off-premises to store their paper documents. The next thing I wanted to hold up to you was a flash drive. Now, I looked online just briefly. There's a flash drive that holds 512 gigabytes. It costs about $20. Now, 1 gigabyte is equal to about 300 songs, downloaded on an MP3 format. 1,000 gigabytes is 1 terabyte. And if you go to this handout, has a little picture of a hard drive there, you'll see that a 5 terabyte desktop hard drive is about $123. And that would hold half the print collection of the Library of Congress. An 8-terabyte hard drive is about $209, as you see there on the sheet. Another concern the stakeholders is fulfilling data requests. Government entities can lower their costs and time regarding requests by setting up their system to separate public from non-public on the front end. They can also seek out vendors with products that are designed to meet data practices, needs, and requirements. They can also place commonly requested public data on their website. It is important for government entities to budget for records management systems and to comply with the records management statutes and the Data Practices Act. Making data available to the public is part of the cost of doing business in Minnesota. It is simply good for government's internal operations. It is important to point out here that statute says a reasonable amount of time is allowed to fulfill large requests. The responsible authority should work with the data requester to make the requests as specific as possible. And know that requests can be done in segments, fulfilling a portion of that request at a time. Mr. Chair, those are my opening comments. I'd like to get on with testimony, if we could, at this time.
Yes, very well. First to testify, Matt Ealing. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Matt Ealing with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. We thank Representative Scott for bringing this bill forward and highlighting this issue. We support HF 1185. We think that it brings needed standardization to the retention of correspondence by government entities. Now, in previous testimony before this committee, I've talked about the value of correspondence, including email, and the value it holds for government oversight. You'll recall the email-based examples that I discussed, including the New Jersey Bridgegate scandal, as well as the press investigation into the 35W bridge collapse here on a local level. There are many, many other examples I could bring. I'm sure other testifiers will bring their own examples to the table. I would note that many legislators recognize the importance of this issue. This is one of 4 email bills that have been brought forward by both Democratic and Republican authors this session. I want to spend the balance of my time today talking about why this bill is important, give you some background, and talk about the mechanics of how it works. Now, this discussion about email retention and records retention more broadly has been coming for a long time, but recent events have really brought it to the fore. As mentioned previously, many government entities already keep their correspondence for a 3-year retention period that's recommended by the MHS retention schedules. However, in recent years, some entities have been searching for ways to reduce the amount of correspondence they're holding, and they're turning to limiting what they define as official correspondence. That's the legal mechanism that many of them are using. An early indication of this trend was seen at the governor's office. If you look on page 2 of our packet, you'll see a records retention schedule that had been adopted by the Ventura administration. And that limits the emails that they're required to keep to only those they consider to be records of official transactions. And this guidance continues to be in place today. It's been in place over 3 gubernatorial administrations. If you talk to local reporters, you'll discover that this definition of official has been very fluid in practice. During the Pawlenty administration, they considered very, very few emails to be official. They largely retained the text of executive orders or other final decisions that they had transmitted by email. 2 years ago, MinnPost had written about how it attempted to obtain email records from Governor Dayton's office, and they learned that nearly all of the relevant data that they were seeking in that instance had been deleted. And so again, this turns on the ability of that office to distinguish between what it considers official and what it considers not to be official. And this trend has spread. So 2 years ago, the city of St. Paul modified its email retention policy to reduce the amount of email that it was holding. As reported by the Pioneer Press, the city had previously been holding correspondence for 3 years, and it auto-deleted after 3 years. In 2015, the city started asking employees to move only their official correspondence into desktop folders, and they started auto-deleting emails after 6 months. If you look at the city's email retention policy found in your packet, you'll note that it states that records that are not official are not subject to the city's retention policy and do not need to be maintained. In another recent situation, the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office changed its email retention period to only 30 days. This is the shortest that we know of. That change occurred in August of 2016, a few months after software engineer Tony Webster had prevailed in a legal challenge over access to emails about the use of facial recognition software by the Sheriff's Office. Mr. Webster's data request revealed the existence of a technology that no one on the outside of that agency knew was in use, despite the many issues it raises regarding personal privacy and government surveillance. And I think it's fair to say that the legislature did not know about this technology's use until Mr. Webster's data request was made. And the legislature, of course, is the entity tasked with regulating such technologies at a state level. If you look on page 8 of your packet, you'll see the sheriff's email order, which does not really provide much guidance as to what should be saved by employees, other than it needs to be for a legitimate law enforcement or business purpose. So that's the guidance that's provided there. And I would warrant that had this 30-day email order been in place prior to Mr. Webster's request, it's likely that much of the material that he received simply would not have existed, due in part to the broad discretion granted to employees to eliminate non-official email, but due more likely just to the simple attrition of the rapid auto-delete policy itself. So this bill addresses these kinds of issues by instituting a standardized 3-year retention for correspondence, which, as Representative Scott has noted, is in wide use today. The bill also makes a change to Minnesota Statutes 1517, which removes the phrase official records and replaces it with government records. And this matches the existing language in the records retention statute at 138.17, so it aligns the text of those two statutes. And that eliminates the loophole of destroying non-official correspondence. In place of this vague official records designation, the author's amendment introduced this morning, I think, makes another useful change. So what it does is it adds a clearly defined list of things that are not correspondence and which can be deleted inside of the 3-year retention period. And these include things like announcements of social events, purely personal correspondence, and junk mail or other marketing-type communications. And I'd note that these sorts of items stem from a specific category of correspondence found in the Model Cities Retention Schedule, found there today, called transitory correspondence. And under the city's retention schedule, this kind of transitory correspondence does not need to be maintained for 3 years and can be discarded when its function is done. What this author's amendment does is clarify what that actually is and standardizes it across all government entities, so there's no misunderstanding. So before I end, I have a couple notes in summary. The first is that, so there is no misunderstanding, this bill only deals with the retention of text-based correspondence, and it adds that 3-year standardized retention period. Every other piece of government data that's on a retention schedule outside of correspondence is not affected, so that continues to exist under its existing retention schedule. Governments would have the discretion to modify those schedules as they will, provided that the records disposition panel approves. So this just deals with text-based correspondence. Secondly, the issue of cost will be brought up during this discussion. There will be costs associated with this bill, but they are going to vary based on the operations of particular government entities. So if you're a government entity that's keeping correspondence and emails for 3 years right now, very little is going to change for you. If you're keeping them for a shorter amount of time, you will have some more storage costs that will come into play. But those costs need to be measured against, I think, much larger competing costs. Governments today, even at a municipal level, are spending millions of dollars on all manner of programs and projects. And keeping documentation about how those government funds are spent and about how spending and other decisions are made, we think is a very sensible investment to ensure that much, much larger pools of resources are used appropriately. So thank you for your time and attention. I'd be happy to take questions about the bill.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ehling, during the past, I don't know, half dozen years that this body has struggled with overseeing government technologies that we didn't know about, we heard statements from some local units of government that asserted that their agreements with manufacturers precluded their even mentioning anything about the existence of the technology. How would those outside agreements be impacted by this law?
Mr. Ehling.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. To the extent, well, let me back up and say, first of all, government entities should not be signing those kinds of agreements. The contracts about what they're procuring should be public. They should not be including or acquiescing to language like that. Now, to the extent that any of that contractual language about what kind of surveillance technology or other technology they're purchasing exists in a contract that's been emailed, say, as an attachment to an email, that would be preserved for the three-year standard period under this retention proposal.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Ehling, I happen to agree with you that I don't think entities over which we have constitutional oversight should be entering agreements that require them to hide things from the overseers. I think that's highly inappropriate. However, not everybody agrees with me. Some people think there are great reasons to have secret technologies. And these agreements, as I understand it, preclude any discussion, even mentioning the technology, not even information about the technology in an attachment. But if you're emailing with Acme, whatever, body cams or whatever it is, which we know about body cams now, so that's irrelevant, but that that would prohibit them from using essentially a government email account, as I understand it, to email a manufacturer inquiring about this. Is that correct?
Mr. Ehling.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Let me come at your question from a little different way. The legislature, because of this very issue, because the corporation that manufactures the Stingray device has included some of this language in their contractual language, the legislature added specific language to 1382, the law enforcement section of the Data Practices Act, specifying that the existence of technology purchased by law enforcement agencies is public data. So the state law, as I'm reading it, would trump any contractual language that would say otherwise.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Howe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question goes is, you say that this only applies to text. So how about those voicemails that now go over to your computer and now are a voice data? And I know that there's technology now converts that to text. Now, how is this going to affect that retention?
Mr. Ehling.
Thank you, Representative Powell. If a government agency is purely maintaining the audio, that is going to fall under a different retention schedule, depending on whether the government agency has adopted a retention schedule for voicemails, for instance. If you're using software that creates a transcription of the voicemail, then you have created text-based correspondence that would be retained under this schedule or proposed schedule.
Representative Howe.
Well, I think I know what I'm doing from now on.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ehling, for your testimony. Next up is John Manillo, and after that is Michael Kiefer. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
John Manillo. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm here to testify in favor of this bill. I'm John Manillo. I speak for St. Paul Strong, a nonpartisan group of citizens who believe the welfare of our communities are based on transparency and accountability of their government. Our elected officials and the departments they oversee too often give us reason to distrust their actions and motivations. In St. Paul, the policy to delete email communications after 180 days may be its most blatant example for lack of transparency and has resulted in loss of public trust. Without trust, most any action taken by government will be suspect. Unfortunately, this has been proven to be the case. By allowing any city employee to unilaterally delete any email communication with only minimal training, we are allowing truth to be buried and history to be erased. There will always be questions as to whether our elected officials are more concerned with their short-term political future rather than that of long-term good public policy. How will they be accountable? We should never enable the potential abuse of our trust. Thank you.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Michael Kiefer, and next up is Sheila Van Pelt. Good morning. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Michael Kiefer. I'm here to testify on behalf of this bill, in favor of this bill, as a technical expert on email archiving or the long-time storage of email. I work for a company by the name of Interdyne. We are based in Mendota Heights, Minnesota, and we sell an email archiving solution. We have many counties in the state of Minnesota that use our product. I believe that number is actually, there's 14 counties currently using our product. And many other counties and cities around the country. And so I can directly testify to the cost of an email archiving solution. And it's much less than some government entities would have you to believe. I believe Anoka County provided Representative Scott with an estimate of how much an email archiving solution would cost them. And the costs were up to and above, well over $150,000 over the course of 3 years. That, in fact, is not the case. Our solution is currently in use. As an example, Ocean County, New Jersey, they have roughly a population of 500,000 citizens, and they have a 10-year email retention policy. Their system costs them $15,000. Including the first 3 years of support, ongoing maintenance is only $3,000 a year. So if there's any questions into what email archiving technology can do, I'd be happy to answer that.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a little awkward since I'm the presenter and the chair, but I wanted just to have Mr. Kiefer speak to how you what the technology looks like that makes the retrieval of data for data requests easier. What does that look like in a kind of in terminology for a novice to...
Mr. Kiefer.
Sure. Thank you. So basically the process is on the email server, so the device that is sending and receiving the email, you set that up where it will make an independent copy of each email, and then that copy is directed to the archive solution. So it's a totally separate copy that is controlled on the archive device. You can set separate retention policies on that device to maintain how long those emails are kept. From the archive, it's very easy to go in and do very specific searches, whether you're looking just simply for sender and receiver information or words anywhere in the email, including attachments of the email. So you can very quickly go in and do very complex searches looking to or from specific recipients, and even excluding emails that contain certain texts that may not be relevant. So you can go through many millions of emails in literally minutes to find what you're looking for.
Follow-up, Representative Scott?
That's what I was wanting to
get. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. This is a question for the... Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Name.
Mr. Kiefer.
Mr. Kiefer?
Kiefer.
Kiefer. Mr. Kiefer, are you a private for-profit company?
Mr. Kiefer.
Yes, we are.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. Mr. Kiefer, are there other protections in law related to your handling of that data and protections, or is that solely done by your contracts with government entities?
Mr. Kiefer.
In most cases, we are not actually handling the data. We are providing a physical computer that the government entity would purchase and they would manage. And so the data is all staying underneath their roof and underneath their management. It's just being stored on a very specific product that can handle the storage more efficiently long-term than an email server can.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kiefer, are there also regulations? We saw that there's allegations that a foreign entity hacked potentially our elections. At least those are some of the allegations that were made. What kinds of protections do you have to have under the law to protect this government data from hackers?
Mr. Kiefer.
It's essentially no different than what is currently being done with the email server that's currently storing the emails today. This is just a separate device that's basically going to would be, in most cases, in parallel in the same room is that device. So it's just a separate copy of the data being maintained in a more efficient manner. Our software does have protections in place, if they're implemented properly, that will protect the data from hackers. But with most computer systems, it's up to the operator, the manager of the computer system, to actually implement it correctly to reduce the threat from hackers.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one final question. Does your contract call for a liability of your company in the event that your software ends up being the problem which resulted in someone getting data that they aren't supposed to be getting?
Mr. Kiefer.
My response to that question would be no. Actually, I've never heard that question because you're talking, I think there's a misunderstanding of an email server and the email archive. Email is much more vulnerable when it's in transit, when it's being transmitted from point A to point B. Our device stores a separate copy of the data, and you can very closely limit who has access to that device to get to that data.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, closing comment.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, this was just a clarification based on his answer to the question. But isn't it your software that you write for the program to retrieve the information, right, so that you're actually kind of writing the search of then what they're looking for what's public or what's private?
Mr. Kiefer.
Our software provides the mechanism where they can do a search through it. So they have fields where they can indicate we want to search for emails, you know, to or from this particular person, and that those emails contain particular words.
So, Mr. Chair, that...
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if a government entity relies on your search and they get it wrong based on the search and the way you've programmed, who's liable for the failure to disclose data that should have been disclosed or the disclosure of data that shouldn't be disclosed?
Mr. Kiefer.
It's okay. You can give me that answer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. I know. I think. But what I want to say, I guess, right now, it's better to have the data available so that it can be searched. In some of the previous testimony, you know, in the discussions of, you know, what is a public record, what is not a public record, there's someone making really a subjective decision as to is this a public record or not. If you look back at, you know, in New Jersey, the Bridgegate scandal I think you had heard about previously, they took specific steps to circumvent their email archive, their email storage system, because they knew what they were doing was probably not legal or not acceptable, so they tried to avoid being caught. Isn't it better to have a solution like this in place where all emails are kept, and then after the fact, someone can make the decision as to whether or not it's a public record or not? Just because the data is being kept doesn't mean it's public. The public does not have access to this data and needs to go through an administrator, potentially legal teams, to determine should this be shared with the public or not and what parts of it should be shared. There are cases where emails, and we actually have within our solution the ability to redact data from within an individual email. So if the public requests an email from law enforcement and that email contains the name of a juvenile, which would be excluded from being public record, the rest of the text is, that name is not, they can redact that information from that email before they make it public.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my question is to the testifier, a couple questions. So we met in advance as well with one of your competitors, I think, and there are multiple competitors in this space, in the email archive space. And in that conversation, they explained to us that the licensing model for them is not per size of the data that's being kept, but instead per user. So my question for you is your licensing model per mailbox, per user,
or is it per size of the mailbox, the amount of data that's being retained?
Mr. Kiefer.
Thank you. Our licensing model primarily is based on total storage capacity, so the volume of email that's being stored.
Representative Lucero.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I highlight that. So in this particular vendor, they do charge per size, but there are other vendors out there that charge per user. And I highlight that because that is a very relevant question in terms of the units of government that would retain data. As it grows, one of the questions in their mind is, how much is it going to cost us based on the size? And there are licensing models out there that don't, the size is irrelevant because the storage has come down so much in cost and has essentially become a commodity that it's the number of users. So that's important to highlight. The second thing I'd like to highlight is this particular vendor, it sounds like they're an on-prem solution, but they may also have off-premises, what that stands for. So if their email server is on the location of where the employees or users are, that their solution, their archive solution, might be on-prem as well. But there are other solutions where the email server itself may be up in the cloud, and then the archive solution may also be in the cloud. So that also are other variables in terms of architecting units of government, architecting solutions to being compliant if this bill were to become law. And that's also very important because, as we may hear the testifiers, the costs are there are many different variables that need to be factored in. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. And then I guess my last question for the testifier is, your solution allows you to perform queries against it. So does that mean as emails are coming in, as it's being archived, you are, one, indexing those emails as they're coming in, so keyword searches can be performed at a subsequent date with the search parameters. And then number two, as we're, most of us are familiar with emails, there are many duplicative. If somebody were to reply and then reply again, you have multiple duplications of the same email. Does your solution index? And then number two, does it deduplicate the emails in order to reduce the amount of space that's required to archive?
Mr. Kiefer.
Thank you. Yeah, so a number of questions there. First, a little bit about our technology. We do, I was speaking primarily about our on-premise technology. We do also offer it as a cloud service. The cloud service we do sell on a per mailbox basis. So I'm familiar with both technologies. Our particular product, we do actively index the data as it's being received. So it basically becomes, I wouldn't say instantly searchable, but searchable within minutes of it being received on the archive. And we do also deduplicate the data, and we do a very aggressive amount of deduplication. There's a couple different ways deduplication can be called. The first is single instancing, whereas if a message is sent to more than one person, we only keep one copy of that message, but it's still searchable by all the recipients. So if I send an email to everyone in this room on the email server, there would be 100 copies of that email. On our product, there's only going to be one copy of that email. We also go a step further and we'll deduplicate data down to the attachment level. So that very same email I just described that I sent to 100 people, if there were two attachments on there, there would be 400 or 200 attachments out there. On our system, we would only keep one copy of each attachment, and the content of that attachment would also be searchable just as email.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This will be my last comment. So that's great information. And that's very important information as this conversation progresses. There is a handout here, a fact sheet from the League of Minnesota Cities, I think it is. And they say that if this were to become law, that searching for data will become exponentially more difficult. And I categorically reject that statement because the opposite is true. If you have decentralized and you have user mailboxes spread across 100 users, for example, 100 employees, by implementing an email archive solution, you're actually consolidating. Instead of having 100 different locations to potentially search, you bring it to one location. So staff time is actually reduced. And then it says, another statement here, will add significant cost to the city's bottom line. I don't agree with that statement whatsoever. I think the technology has allowed for capabilities to be more efficient. and more responsive to government transparency. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and two short questions. One, your system only does email, correct?
Mr. Kiefer.
That is correct.
You don't handle any, Mr. Chair? Your system doesn't handle any other document, and it does not handle text message, that type of data.
Mr. Kiefer.
It can be used to archive certain types of social media, and basically that is done by transforming the social media into an email, which then makes it searchable on our product. So we can grab, you know, capture a tweet or a post on Facebook and submit it into our archive, and it becomes searchable just as emails are. But primarily, we are an email archiving solution.
Thank you, Mr. Kiefer. Next up to testify is Sheila Van Pelt, and then the department. And I'm going to ask members in the interest of time to withhold their questions, and we'll hear all of them at the end. The list of testifiers is growing. State your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, Chairman, members of the committee, and to you, Madam Chair. My name is Sheila Van Pelt. I'm happy to be here and very happy to testify wholeheartedly in support of this bill. Why I'm here today is I am a citizen who has gone through the process of data practices. I'm here to take personal experiences and to put it forth into legislation to make real differences for other people. This is my work that the Star Tribune most graciously put out in 2013. It was talking about my investigations done with the Minnesota Department of Health HMO Office of Health Facility Complaints. I also had an HMO investigation concurrently done at the same time. And I bought tons of data, lots of data. And I was able to compare facts and put forth reasons why we need to look at the holes in the net that we have in our investigations. Many of you, thank God, voted for Mr. Noble's office to do a program evaluation on the Minnesota Department of Health complaint process. Okay, now what I have with this data is factual experiences, and then you start out by wanting to know more, because if I have this much information, probably more than anyone else, how can I make a difference with what God essentially put in my lap? So you start asking questions when things don't add up, and you ask for records. And so in 2013, I originally started out asking records from the Minnesota Department of Health on these investigation outcomes. And to learn more, compare it with my data, and I hope Mr. Nobles doesn't mind, but when we've met a couple of times, I told you I was waiting for information from CMS on a data practices request that the Minnesota Department of Health had to turn over so I could do analysis work for him. Not that he asked, but that I wanted to do graciously for the benefit of others.
Ms. Van Pelt, can we stick to the contents of this bill, please?
Okay, to the point of this, data is important. And right now, without it, when we just sometimes learn much later in our work, that we really need information that would have gone back in time that's most helpful. And when we get rid of it, we don't have it. And right now I wanted to tell you, between the other additional data practices requests, I want to know why, when I have 2 out of 2 investigations done, it doesn't matter to the state. And I can't get any answers. And right now, please know this, without the help of chair people to put forth data practices requests, they aren't being answered. And that is happening with the Minnesota Department of Health. We need to hold on to these things. We have to have our commissioners and responsible authorities adhere to statutes so we can learn. And to remember, information, people need to remember who they work for. It's us and not for themselves. And I am most concerned that this information is being used to contain and not work for us. And one last thing. I'm also concerned with the subjectivity of what data comes out versus the objectivity, and I think we need to seriously look at that, as I have that as an ongoing issue in one of my data practices requests. And with that, I just want to say, please look to holding on to this data. We learn so much, and when it's destroyed, we all lose. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there a representative from the Department of Administration that would wish to testify? And next up is David Maida. Good morning. Please state your name for the record.
Good Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Lori Barkpensky. I'm with the Department of Administration.
Hi, my name is Lenore Madigan, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. And Commissioner Mossman had another commitment this morning and was unable to attend. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on House File 1185. The Department of Administration and our partners in other agencies support meaningful government transparency practices and policies. And we take very seriously our responsibility to maintain public records as required by law. This file would dramatically expand the amounts and type of data that an agency would retain in order to comply with the records retention requirements outlined in Chapters 15 and 138, and could potentially diminish rather than enhance genuine transparency. In an effort to help ensure that the expectations for government transparency are met, and the Department of Administration and all state agencies are able to comply with the law, we want to share with you today how the proposed changes in this file will impact state agencies.
Mr. Chair, Lori Barkpensky again. As you know, Chapter 15 and 138 sets that governments should retain their official records, and records retention sets a minimum of how long those records should be kept. Chapter 13 really controls access while those records exist, as well as access rights for folks. Chapter 13 also requires that data be kept easily accessible for convenient use. An iPad frequently trains that government needs to understand their obligations to both create and maintain official records and to follow their retention schedules. These laws work together and recognize that ensuring transparency, governments are also expected to be good stewards of government data by securing the data that they have and collecting and maintaining only the data they need to perform their work responsibly, efficiently, and effectively. This bill really eliminates the current distinction, which is a crucial distinction, between government data that is correspondence and official records. The proposed legislation really equates all government correspondence with government transparency. And we have reached out to our colleagues in other agencies to better understand how these changes are going to impact folks. What we can say is that state agencies will be required to keep substantially more data than they do now, that it would make it more difficult to secure the data it retains, and more costly to both search, retrieve, and store that data. There are potentials to impact worker productivity, and then also increasing the time it takes to respond to data requests without necessarily improving meaningful transparency. One of your testifiers mentioned that his email solution would keep one copy of 100 emails. What we find is we manually do that now. If there are email change among 10 people, 10 different strings, we give the person the full email exchange versus 100 copies of it, because we find it more useful for the people to be able to see the full package than multiple copies. What we really often hear from customers as well is just how long it takes government to retrieve and search through their records to separate public and not public data, as well as the concern that government is not documenting, is not creating the official records that they ought to be creating. This bill could, in fact, lengthen the time it takes to respond, because even though folks could set up parameters on the front side, email is by its nature going to be a mix of public and not public data all the time. I email someone about, I'll email my son's teacher about something and then say, I hope your mom's knee surgery went well. There's no way to, on the front side, separate that into who's allowed to have access to it and what is public and what's not public. Because the name of the school and the name of the student in my school district is public. So that piece is public, but our email isn't. So then that gets redacted. So every email really has to get pulled apart, and that can really only, it can't be automated, at least now. It has to be done by people who read and understand the classification of the data. So this bill can, in fact, lengthen that time and wouldn't address the issue that data requesters have right now of where government is just not creating the records that they ought to be creating to document official activities. This has an answer to KEVA's Keep All Correspondence, but it doesn't actually address what if you're not documenting the premises behind your actual official actions. And one of the also, the premises of these laws and how we emphasize in training is that Chapter 13, in fact, prohibits government from collecting and retaining more than they need to do their work, so that it always is about making sure you have the data you need to do your work and not more and not for longer, because more isn't always better. This helps to ensure that staff do not retain substantial amounts of unneeded, not public data that they're required to protect. So if this bill were to pass in its current form, a substantial amount of unnecessary, not public data, like I'm going to be 5 minutes late for the staff meeting, are going to be kept, and you're not going to have more meaningful government transparency. You'll just have more data that then has to be pulled apart.
As you know, state agencies already are required to and do retain substantial amounts of data to comply with state laws and ensure transparency. The goal of this bill is to enhance meaningful transparency, but expanding the data retention requirements may not achieve that outcome. In fact, it's likely that staff will be required to spend more time assembling the requested information, and even though it is more information, it may not substantially improve the information that the public has requested. We're concerned that the proposal does not take into account transparency, ease of use, the resources necessary to fulfill requests, and the cost of protecting the data. The focus, we think, should be on providing the requester with that information they need instead of making the amount of information they get bigger. Finally, we are working in coordination with other state agencies to prepare a fiscal note. After it's complete, we hope that we'll provide you with a better understanding of the cost of this proposal.
Thank you for that testimony. We'll review that fiscal note in the Finance Committee, not in this committee. Thank you very much for your testimony. Please stay in case there's any questions at the end. Next up is David Maida, and on deck is Grace Kelleher and Valerie Goslin. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, I hope it's okay that I do some introductory remarks, and then David Maida will go next. For the record, my name is Irene Gow, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. And many of the testifiers already have done some overview over the complicated nature of data practices as well as records management law. And I just wanted to do a quick overview and then turn it over to David in terms, or Mr. Maida, of some of the practical implications. But I did want to focus my overview specifically on cities. So as was previously mentioned, the records management law and data practices is meant to balance both the public's right to know as well as cities' duties for creation, maintenance, and destruction of records. There was some mention of some news articles recently of email retention policies that it's retained to a shorter period. And one of the things that's important to know about that is that the email retention policies are addressing specific types of data that's not covered by a general record retention schedule. So was mentioned, Chair Scott actually talked about the records disposition panel. When there is a schedule that needs to be approved, the records disposition panel needs to approve it. It needs to be done by the Attorney General for legal compliance, the state archivist, who we heard from, for historical compliance, and the state auditor, financial compliance. And that is to make sure that we're actually keeping the records that we need to. That is done even if a city creates their own schedule and doesn't adopt the general one as well. Now, if a request comes and it is, let's say that it's not the form that matters. So a request comes and let's say it's looking for, let me back up, I apologize. One of the things that the records contains, or the schedule contains, is that there are actually 29 categories and 700 specific types of records, and that is a lot of records that's considered. So if an email, for an example, is one of those records, and the example that I was thinking of was if there is an email complaint from a resident about a neighbor's property, it doesn't matter that it's an email or if it were a letter. That record needs to be kept for 7 years. With the email retention policies, if it doesn't cover one of those 700 records, then that policy, mostly transitory data or transitory messages, which was discussed earlier, that's what the policy addresses. And those are the types of emails that were discussed earlier. I'm going to be late for a meeting, or maybe final confirmation of location, or time of a meeting, things like that. Now, with that general overview, I wanted to turn it over to Mr. Maida.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Maeda. I'm the Minnetonka City Clerk, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities in opposition to House File 1185. I will mention that for the last 3 years, I have conducted the electronics records management training at the Minnesota Clerks and Finance Officers Association, and what I thought would be a very unpopular topic where no one would show up at my training. Our trainings are always, the room is full. So city clerks throughout the state are very, very conscious of this, of electronic records management. We appreciate Representative Scott's author's amendment that excludes some types of correspondence, but cities are still concerned about the broad scope of the bill. There are many routine tasks that are accomplished in written or electronic text-based communication that don't provide the public much value, but would administratively and financially be costly. I think you received a letter from the Edina City Clerk that written testimony that explains when we're putting something together as routine as a council packet, it generates a lot of emails that are, at this point, transitory. They're technical and clarifying questions that our city manager might have about certain council items. I think the official record, as it should be, is what we actually submit to the council, and there are many other examples of routine things we do, like accounts payable, many things we do that just generate a lot of emails that at this point are transitory and I don't think would provide the public much useful information. I will kind of cut my testimony short. The large volume of email that has no public value was highlighted in a recent data practices request that our city received. I had to review 1 year's worth of emails for all employees. The request was for all city email over the past year that had specific words or phrases in it. We do have an email archiving system in Minnetonka that we just recently implemented. So this did help with the data practices request. Our software representative, Lucy Chero, doesn't have the duplicating capability. So there were tens of thousands of emails that were generated for the search of these certain phrases or words that we had to go through. And I had to go through each and every one of them to make sure there was no non-public or private data in the email. And to your point about liability, I think if I had missed an email, the city would have been liable for releasing non-public data. So we did have to, before we released all these tens of thousands of emails to the requester, to go through each and every one to make sure we weren't releasing non-public or private data. I think it was very eye-opening to see the amount of spam that we get, and I understand under this bill spam would not be something we would have to keep, but the vast majority of emails that we went through for this particular request were either spam or meeting invites or conference invites, just things that really don't have any public value, I would argue. And with that, I'll turn it back to Irene.
I just wanted to address a couple of things that were brought up, as Mr. Maeda brought up. Thank you, Representative Scott, for the author's amendment. One of the things I would make the committee aware of is that under the city general record retention schedule, when we're talking about transitory messages, it's actually broader than the amendment. The language provides that transitory messages, email, so email is contemplated, social media or phone messages of short-term interest, which are considered incidental or non-vital correspondence. That's what's considered transitory, and that would encompass some of the things that Mr. Maeda brought up. To Representative Lucero, for your questions, I appreciate your concerns, and I admit that storage, when it comes to technology, has gotten cheaper and cheaper. The complicating factor is that it's not just the storage. It's in addition to the storage, the backup, disaster recovery planning, in addition that cities have to provide and governments have to provide. And so it's not that it's just the storage. It's that because this is greater amount of data, then everything is expanded, and that's where it's exponential compared to what we are doing now. Now, as mentioned earlier, the department is going to be having a fiscal note. Cities will also be asking for a local impact note, and I understand that's not being considered by this committee. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Next, Grace Kelleher and Valerie Doslin, and then Keith Carlson. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doslin, and I represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. To be quite honest, I'm still personally trying to kind of get my head around exactly the impact that this means on school districts. I am reaching out to some school district technology coordinators to get an understanding of how school districts currently operate in regards to the storage of electronic data. I do have a lot of questions about what kind of data would have to be retained, very similarly to what you heard in regards to the cities and the and iPad as well. I mean, while I understand that student data is private, I don't fully have a full understanding yet of the laws in regards to how far does student data go. For example, if a parent communicates to a teacher via email about a parent-teacher conference or a concern that might be happening, is that data private? I don't know the answer to that. It may very well be. So, again, I'm trying to get a better understanding. I'd like to extend an offer to Representative Scott if I could bring some technology people to come and sit down and talk with you through this and just see for us to get a better understanding. We do have concerns, but some of that admittedly might be we don't fully understand the breadth of this.
And if I could interrupt you, once you have a better understanding of the bill, if you could bring your comments forward, then that would be outstanding.
Well, certainly.
Great.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. Representative Scott, thank you for the opportunity to get up and share some of our concerns. We're a lot like what Ms. Dozlin referred to. We're trying to get our head around what this would mean for school districts. Part of it is oftentimes you folks don't really think about school districts. We're a very different entity than the townships, counties, or cities. Our main objective is to work with children. And so all those documents, and I wrote down all kinds of different scenarios in school, but let me give you an example that really happened. A school district was asked by a news organization to give all their special ed IEPs, so the plan for the child in school, because they wanted to review them. We truly are the redaction kings of data practices. So we actually had an attorney who had to go one by one. This is a personal one. This we need to redact here or there. And we got it out. And I don't think it was ever used as a news story. So I think our concern goes with, because we deal with students so heavily, and email has been something we've reached out to busy parents to keep them involved with their school district. It's sort of integral to our success to have parents involved. So as Ms. Dozlin stated, we really want to work with you, Representative Scott, and see if we can't be really fair for school districts. What are their expectations with their So, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the time.
Thank you for the testimony. And a brief comment. I dispute the premise of your initial underlying statement that this committee and this author of this bill does not think of the school district or the children that go to that school. Thank you for your testimony. Up next, Keith Carlson, and after that is Kent Sulem. Good morning. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association. Some of the previous testifiers, Ms. Baer-Kospinski and Irene Giles, started to touch on really the complications that are involved here. First, I just want to start with sort of a graphic representation of what we're talking about here. We're talking about the intersection of records retention policy that I would say graphically represents this much data that has to be retained for historical purposes and to document the official actions of government. And we're talking about data practices that currently would involve this. Every piece of data that a local government unit or a state government unit retains is subject to a data practices request. It goes far beyond our official records that are subject to approval by the Attorney General, in the case of local governments, by the state auditor, and by the state archivist. And finally, under this bill, basically, you're expanding it to this. Emails are not particularly transitory emails, as has already been discussed, are not routinely retained by local governments. There is no policy to retain them in their separate records retention systems. The second point I want to make is one that Ms. Gao has already indicated, as well as Ms. Baer-Kempinski. There is absolutely expense involved with the storage, backup, and emergency or disaster recovery of official records. But the much, much more costly part of it is the review in response to a data practices request. Each Basically, I think it was inferred, but I'll go through again. Whenever we receive a data practices request, it's never for a specific document or a specific set of documents. Basically, we receive the request from an individual. We come to an agreement, what terms do you want us to search on? And then we do that search. Then we come up with the response of that search. At that point, then, we have to use frequently an attorney to go through those records to determine what's confidential, what's non-public, what's private data, strike them from the data that has been requested, and then provide it for inspection for these individuals. That's the costly part of this process. And since you're expanding what's available for search to this, you are going to make it much, much more expensive for us to respond to those requests without, as has already been suggested, substantially enhancing the transparency or the utility of access to that data. I do want to respond a little bit further to the hardware issue. An email system is not a records retention system. I would hazard a guess that most of you don't know what happens when you press the delete button on your emails or you swipe it across your smartphone or on your tablet. That has to be very carefully documented, set up, and many of you, I guess, don't really know, in fact, what was set up on your particular computer because your child, your grandchild, or your Verizon or so on has done that for you. Without knowing that, you don't know whether it's being retained or not. Further thing I'll just point out is this is not an issue for you since the legislature is not subject to data practices. I frankly wish you were, so, because until you actually walk the walk, frankly, from our perspective, we don't think you should be talking the talk. At this point, I'll conclude. I'd be happy to answer any questions. This is a substantial, very costly unfunded mandate on local governments. We appreciate the amendment that this representative has offered, but it's still a very costly undertaking of what we're talking about.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem, General Counsel and Director of Governmental Relations for the Minnesota Association of Townships. We represent 1,779 of the 1,781 townships in the state, the vast majority of which are served by well-intentioned volunteers. It may be a very small monthly stipend, but it's not a full-time job. It's not even a part-time job. It's what they do in the evening, and they do it to their best abilities. We, as an association, put most of our efforts into training so that these officers can comply with the law. Unfortunately, as I'm reading through this bill, and I appreciate the author's amendment trying to provide some more clarity, I don't think we're there yet. And as a matter of fact, I think some of the efforts to make it clearer have actually made it a little more ambiguous. We have, if you look at the bill summary provided by Health Research, the distinction between official and unofficial records no longer exists, but it's still a record. Now, what are we supposed to do with that? At what point do you save it, not save it? We have a lot of definitions to say here's what's not included, but it's not at all clear what is included. And lastly, to me, at the township level, the most concerning portions of this bill are the ones that are striking, for example, line 3.19, data and information that does not become part of the transaction. The striking earlier of made or received pursuant to law or in conjunction with the transition of public business on 211. That's the opening is up saying that essentially everything becomes a record. It may be a unofficial record, but it's still a record. And now we've got more ambiguity as to, well, what do we do with this? So I appreciate the efforts, and I hope that we can keep talking, but at this time, I would have a very difficult situation trying to get our members to stay in compliance with the bill.
Duly noted. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Lesh has a brief comment before we move on to Jim Nobles. Representative Lesh,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson? Mr. Carlson, I've served up here 15 years now. I don't think I've ever heard that kind of persuasive tactic in pushing a certain type of legislation. You may be upset about the fact that this committee, which, by the way, has constitutional oversight duties over local units of government, is considering a bill that may place additional burdens upon your clients, and I get that. However, the United States Constitution does not recognize local units of government. It recognizes federal and state, and that means the buck stops at the state. So whether or not you think that it's a bad idea for the legislature to exempt itself from data practices, that decision has been made by this body that oversees you. Representative Thiessen has introduced a bill that revokes that exemption, and I have signed on to it as second author, and I think it's a good idea to revoke that. That said, the reason we're here considering this bill is because local units of government, not all of them, but local units of government have been irresponsible in disclosing information that the citizens are entitled to. So the suggestion that you know, guys don't even deserve to be talking about this in any way, I find ridiculous, and I'm surprised to have heard it from you, who is a knowledgeable testifier and typically well represents your clients and has done so for many years.
Thank you. On to Representative, on to Jim Nobles. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor. I would like to thank you for considering this issue and thank Representative Scott for her bill. This, in my view, would help the work that the legislative auditor does on your behalf in terms of investigations. We do often obtain emails as a part of our work, and there is an ambiguity, I think, that this bill is trying to address as to what kinds of emails are going to be retained. So you've heard from the citizen perspective. There is a journalism perspective. There's this perspective of legislators. I just wanted you to hear the perspective of an auditor who also does investigations and audits and evaluations on your behalf. And this will enhance our ability to do that. I would also like to just say, in response to the last interchange, the Office of the Legislative Auditor is subject to the Government Data Practices Act and has been for decades. So we do walk the walk. We don't just talk the talk, as was suggested. So we understand every day what it is to be subject to the Government Data Practices Act. And we are an organization that documents documents, and we keep those documents just like the other people who've testified. And frankly, I don't see that this bill increases the burden on us one bit, because it's already a part of our responsibility. And we, if need be, we will also explore the new technology that solves some of the problems that have been addressed. But for now, as one who does keep a lot of records, I don't see that this really adds to our burden. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the audience who has not testified who wishes to do so? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Tom Erickson. Okay.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Tom Erickson, St. Paul, Minnesota. And I was curious about this. I didn't plan to testify, but I felt compelled I had to. I'm a retired CEO of a medical device company. We have about 300 employees in the United States and about 350 in Korea. So it's that size of company. And as many companies are in our business, somewhat litigation adverse, but there's a lot of it going around. And so we had to, by request of our law firm, which I believe is the biggest law firm in the state of Minnesota, they came up, of course, we wanted to keep it as little as possible, and they said the absolute minimum that we could go with 3 years. They said anything less than 3 years would be looked adversely by the courts. It would look like we're trying to hide things, and we would be in trouble potentially if any type of litigation came up on certain matters. So I just assumed that 3 years was the minimum. When I learned, and this is why I'm here today, I'm just curious, when I heard about this situation in Minnesota, how can the public institutions be treated so much different, so much more liberally than the private institutions and the corporations, and be so far out of the envelope? As far as our company and the size of our company, which is probably has as many employees as many cities do, it was not a problem keeping this information. Not a problem at all. The expense is very, very little. In fact, I didn't even notice it. I know we had technology people that were handling this, and I don't think they were really handling it very often. It just all operates automatically. If there is litigation, they go on keyword searches. So all these, we had literally hundreds of thousands of emails annually. And if you went back several years, you're talking about millions of emails, and with keyword searches and the rest of it, would very quickly all types of information that was pertinent to a subject would come up, and everything else was discarded by the search. So, again, I'm testifying because I do not believe that a public institution should be treated differently than a private institution. If anything, because of its fiduciary responsibility to the taxpayers, should be 5 years or 7 years, something more than what we had to live by with 3 years. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, my name is Don Demerling. I'm with the Coalition on Government Information, and I must confess in front of all of you that for about 10 years I was responsible for the statewide program of records management in Minnesota. My funding for that work was one person. Okay? Each budget cycle I went to the Commissioner of Administration and said to the Commissioner, and this is all political vintages, we can't do this job and do it right without funding. And each time I was told that's not a priority. So I found it really interesting that the Department of Administration would testify about all the difficulty of this when historically the department would not play an effective role. Finally, in desperation, I thought, I can talk to people in the legislature about this. But by that time, bureaucrats could not speak directly to you without permission. So I put in a legislative proposal to get rid of the Department of Administration's role in being the people who actually help local government do this, help state agencies do that. And it sat on somebody's desk in the governor's office for a number of years. After I retired, the Department of Administration took that proposal forward. You never heard any testimony that I was present at that explained what that meant, and you got rid of that statewide responsibility of the Department of Administration. Okay? Now, I want to make clear that the people who testified before you were not in management positions at the Department of Administration at that time. But here's the larger problem. What you're looking at is a statute that has been on the books in Minnesota since 1974. All of the complaints you hear about having to do this, what it costs, et cetera, have been on the books since 1974. Any organization, and many of you work in the private sector, any organization, as you heard the previous testifiers tell you, any organization that's doing business in a business-like fashion has an effective records management program. It just does. Because, among other things, it saves money. It helps deal with liability. So keep in mind that we're not talking about, the only thing we're talking about that's really new here is to take a definition that's widely used to avoid public accountability and transparency and trying to do something about it. Because keep in mind, this is the way things work in the real world. A bureaucrat, an elected official, whatever, says, I got an email. I get to decide whether or not it's official, with no definition of that term in Minnesota statutes. If I decide it's not official, then I can send it off to deletion. Now, people like Representative Lucero know that that means it's probably out there somewhere, but most people don't understand that. If I decide it's official, then if I work for an organization that has a records management schedule, I could follow that schedule, and depending upon what the schedule says, currently dump it at either 30 days or dump it in 3 years. Or if it's actual correspondence, I could keep it permanently, which is what the general records retention schedule says for cities. You've heard examples of things that aren't official emails. Well, let's use one of those examples. I'm going to be late by 5 minutes for a meeting. When I was a manager in state government, if I had an employee who was not being attentive to their duties, the personnel pipes would tell me that's the kind of email I should keep to build a record so I could discipline that employee. So often those messages are transitory, but in some cases they're not. A couple of last things, and I'll conclude. You heard comments about you're not walking the walk. Well, I got some strange news for you. You're subject to the records management statute. Most of you don't know that, okay? But you are. If you look in the statute, I can give the citation if you need it. You're actually subject to the records management statute, okay? Lastly, liability. Understand, there's no liability in the Data Practices Act for not disclosing public data when you should, okay? That's one of the things that drives the media crazy. Is there potential liability for releasing not public data? Yeah. And you know how hard it is to prove that? It's extraordinarily difficult, okay? And even more difficult is proving damages when that happens. Oddly enough, most of the cases in which people are able to prove damages are cases involving public employees, because what's attached to the damages is their liability. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Is there anyone else? Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else from the audience who wishes to testify that has not already done so? Seeing no additional testimony, member comments. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to bring up a few more points here. So I've been in the IT industry for about a decade and a half, seen a lot of changes over that time, and some of the regulatory compliance mandates that we've had come down during the time that I've been there, either come down or had to implement, have been Sarbanes-Oxley, HITECH, which is related to HIPAA, it's the enforcement arm of HIPAA, GLBA, which is Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, having to do with financial institutions, and then PCI, it's payment card industry. Now, that's not government mandated, that's industry mandated, but nevertheless, it's stringent compliance mandates that businesses must adhere to. And the sentiments that I'm hearing now are the exact same sentiments that I heard, that all of us in the IT industry heard when these regulatory mandates came down. It's the wailing and gnashing of teeth. What are we going to do? It's going to be cost explosions, etc. The problem is regulatory compliance mandates require a new way of doing things. And so the deficiency that I've seen among all of us is we view new regulatory compliance mandates through the lens of current practices. That's the problem. And so when these new mandates come down, it forces the industry to do things different, to become more efficient. And so 2 years ago, we had a fiscal note. I know this is not a fiscal committee, but I'll just make this point. It was actually another one of Chair Scott's bills related to log retention. And I know that it's kind of an unwritten rule to not question fiscal notes around here, but when I saw that fiscal note, I'll tell you what, at least when it comes to technology-related fiscal notes, my faith in the fiscal note process was destroyed because it was ridiculous, the assumptions made. And the assumptions made relate to the point that I just made, which is it attempted to adhere to a potential bill or mandate through the lens of current processes. And so any fiscal note that comes down, I'm going to be highly skeptical of, because it's going to attempt to adhere to them without having to change the way things are done. So with that said, We've heard BCDR, backup. So BCDR is business continuity and disaster recovery. And none of the issues that were brought up should cause us to pause, because transparency and holding government accountable is the goal. It's the number one fiduciary responsibility. And all of these things can be accomplished, all of them, by changing the way we do things, changing the way government operates, becoming more efficient, and adopting technology that will allow these things to happen. So with that, I'll end, Mr. Chair.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, you know, I've tried to live my life by setting the example and walking the walk. And I find it hard to believe that this body, and we heard from the last testifier that says the data retention probably applies to us, but the other piece of this, the data practices, the data privacy piece, is probably, we don't know quite how that applies to us. But I would say that if it's going to apply to us, we should do the same thing. I find it strikingly difficult to apply this to those levels of government below us if we don't apply it to our same standards and feel the same pain. I guess that's my comment, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other member discussion? Seeing none, Representative Scott, closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Howe, I know in addition to the bill that Representative Lesh mentioned that Representative Thiessen dropped, he also dropped one, I believe it was yesterday, for the Data Practices Commission to do a study on what it would take to get the legislature in compliance with the Data Practices Act. So I will be having another bill shortly that says let's keep the Data Practices Commission going for another 2 years, and that will be one of our topics of discussion, is can that happen? And I have a feeling that would be something that would have to be phased in over time. But at the same time, I fully understand your point. Folks, I ask for your support on this. We've attempted to give a modern-day definition to correspondence with a retention period that reflects the amount of time the records disposition panel deemed appropriate for written correspondence. And I appreciate Representative Lucero's comments that sometimes these new regulations, these new asks of government are viewed through the lens of current processes. And I appreciate people from the private sector being here today to weigh in on what technologies are available, because it's really come a long way. And so with that, members, I would just ask for your support.
With that, Representative Scott renews her motion to House File 1185 be re-referred as amended to the Government Operation and Election Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Next up, House File 1654.
Representative O'Neill, we have House File 1654 before us. Would you like to move your bill? And the motion would be that it would be going to the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
Thank you. Go ahead to your bill, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. This morning I have a bill before you that takes the domestic assault by strangulation, which is a felony conviction, and adds it to the list of other felonies that can be considered when we're talking about child custody, parenting time, and also after the conviction has happened, a revisiting of those. So it's in two different sections of the statute. And if you would, please, if you would take out your bill, because I just want you to look at some of the current felonies that are listed here and understand why we're adding domestic assault by strangulation. So if you look at the bill in front of you, it has things, it has murder for second and third degree, manslaughter in the first degree, it has assault for second and third degree, kidnapping, deprivation of custody or other parental rights, It has other things that are specific to endangering and harming a child. And these are in both sections. So it's both in when you're determining custody up front and also after the conviction has happened and they revisit custody and parenting time. So I'm going to turn it over to my testifier to explain why possibly this was left off and why it's so important to add it in. And before I get there, I just want to let you know that this morning as I was preparing, I actually read Wright County Sheriff's blog. So he blogs and he puts it on Facebook, and he actually lists out everybody that was arrested in the past week. So just in the past week in Wright County alone, there were three felony charges basically for domestic strangulation. So this is a crime that happens often, and I think it should be considered when we're talking about custody, and it should be considered when we're talking about parenting time, either before that is issued, if that's been in the past, or if it happens and they have to revisit that and send it back to family court. So with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier, please.
Good morning. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid, and I want to thank Representative O'Neill for her work on this bill. The bill has broad bipartisan support in both chambers, I'm happy to say, and I've talked with it with many of you, and also a lot of groups who work in this area, related areas, including criminal law, and as far as I know, there's no opposition to the bill. House File 1654 adds convictions for domestic assault by strangulation to the list of statutes in both the criminal section and the family law chapter. They're the identical list of crimes, and that's why we're adding it in both places so they cross-reference correctly. This bill fills a much-needed gap in the law. Under current law, judges are hesitant to change custody or limiting parenting time under the family law chapter when this conviction occurs because it's not specifically enumerated, and that's okay. They're looking at the crimes that are listed, and if it's not in a listed conviction, they tend not to have it. They don't want to expand it beyond what's listed, so there's a gap there. When the crime of domestic assault by strangulation was created by the legislature in 2005, at the same time it was added as a qualified domestic violence-related offense, it was also added to some of the firearms restrictions pieces in current law. And so the domestic violence-related offenses are enhancements for subsequent offenses. And so it was added in those places within Chapter 609, but for some reason it wasn't added into this section of the law. Maybe it was because a different chapter. It precedes my time in the with the legislature working with you all. And so it looks to us as if it was an oversight. Domestic assault by strangulation is a serious crime under Minnesota law. It's a felony with no lesser included. There's no misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor level of it. And it's also subsequently been made a crime of violence under Minnesota law. The crime of domestic assault by strangulation must also be committed against a family or household member in the criminal statute, which really lines it up with the family law statute because they want to look specifically at crimes that are committed against a family or household member. So the language already matches up well, but again, the crime isn't there. The bill is supported by the Coalition for Battered Women and the Family Law Section of the State Bar. We have had cases with this type of an offense. And in fact, we have a case now where a person is serving time and will be out soon. And so this is a very much real issue for us. Strangulation, too, I just wanted to note, is nationally acknowledged as a strong factor in assessing lethality in domestic violence cases. And it's included in bench guides, including Minnesota bench guides for courts to look at for what factors can help predict lethality in domestic violence cases, which directly impact safety. And an article for the Journal for Emergency Medicine indicated that prior non-fatal strangulation is associated with a 600% increase of risk of attempted homicide and a 700% increased risk for completed homicide. So these are very serious things when they happen. They are a very strong risk factor prediction of safety, and that's a significant factor in us moving this crime and these convictions over into both statutes. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hugdahl, is there anything that precludes a judicial officer from currently taking this crime or other crimes into consideration when deciding how to shift burdens for that custody and parenting time?
Representative, or Mr. Madam, Ms. Huggall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's okay. You've had a lengthy bill discussion this morning. Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, not really. I mean, there is an endangerment section under the family law statutes, but that is upon the person who's asking for the change to take place. So in this case, it would actually be if it's the other parent who's the victim, the burden would be on them. So that's what this section of the law, which we're not changing the underlying process of it, that's where that burden shifting resides, is the statute that we're adding it to.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. The reason I ask that is I think it's worthwhile to point out to legislators the problems we sometimes get into when prescribing the parameters which judges should or do look at. When we so heavily prescribe it by law, sometimes judges think they can't do it unless we specifically say they can do it. And I've run into that problem multiple times, especially with new judges. They'll say, well, it's not on the list, so I'm not going to do it. They just go the careful route. And that can be frustrating. And part of that is because we write down so many other things that they can do. And so we have a lot of bills that come through here, and I've carried them, that have said that revenge porn law last year. Technically, if a judge wanted to find a cause of action on that civilly, they could, but they're really hesitant to go out of their way to craft a new one, and a lawyer would have to come in and think of it. So I just wanted legislators to be aware of that. I support the bill, and I think it's good, Representative O'Neill, but unfortunately, I think because of where we're at overall, a lot of times we end up needing these bills when we shouldn't.
Any other member questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to weigh in on this bill? If not, Representative O'Neill renews her motion that House File 1654 be re-referred to the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you. Representative O'Neill, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Pugh. Representative Pugh, would you like to move House File 1554 and this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus data practices bill.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I would like to do that.
Thank you.
Move House File 1544 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Go ahead to your bill.
Hey, thank you. So my bill, in the interest of time, be as quick as possible, my bill clarifies what must be done when a government agency or entity denies a data request and will require the denying agency or entity to not only cite the specific statute that is being used to deny the request, but also the subdivision, paragraph, or clause. And I would draw members and the public's attention to the changes. It's very brief, 2.24 through 2.33. And Madam Chair, I, as you know, I did prepare an amendment. However, the thought and concern came to me after the point at which the amendment would meet the deadline. But it's specific to a nuance created by my bill with regard to protecting identities. So if I could ask the page just to please just pass it out for members' consideration.
Sure, that'd be great.
Thank you. And I will look forward to feedback from members or anyone who has a concern about this, given that we are going to be laying the bill over for consideration, and we can address that. The reason that my bill is so necessary is because Chapter 13 is very large. In fact, as I was taking a look at this and some of the specific statutes, it was drawn to my attention just looking that Chapter 13 is 170 pages long, and there are a number of statutes or a number of components where there are 31 subdivisions I found. So we just think that this is really important to bring some clarity to what really needs to happen. So I do have one testifier. I know I have at least another. And I would also want to draw members' attention to a testimony that was received from Mr. Tom Webster, who was referenced earlier by Mr.
Ealing.
Thank you. And his testimony is in your packet. He was unable to be here today.
Thank you. And to your testifier, please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I've done many, many data requests over the decades for myself, for others, and have worked with reporters, citizens, legislators, their constituents even, to help them understand and to get data. And one of the main things that happens when you ask for public data, you'll either get it or you'll get denied. And where government for decades, if you look at that section, it says the statutory section. This is the reason why you're being denied. Now, most agencies, a great number of agencies, have read that to be the statute. You know, the section would be like 1330-something. And then we'll say the subdivision and say, you know, maybe the cause. But many folks are beginning not to do that. And so when the people are given a denial, they're scratching their head, well, why are they denying it? Because when you are denied, you are given some opportunities to sort of say, is that really legit? Now, if you look in your packet, you'll see three examples of the state statute. You'll see one in 1337. You'll see another one about 13.55. And you'll see one about, just in general, statute. 13.55 deals with the stadium and other venues like the stadium. So when the request was made generally by a reporter, they were given basically, well, it's private and more than likely was told 1355. But if you read the articles in the newspaper and all that, and even my interaction with some of the folks that were involved in that story, I asked, were you aware of the detail or that did they give you the specifics? And my impression is based on that, no, they just gave 13.55. If you look at 13.37, and I'll give you an example, because this was issues with Stingray, license plate readers, and other venues that I've asked for data and then have shared with you the results, which have resulted in policies. I'm sorry, Mr. Neumeister, but we can't give you that data about Stingray, LPR, or whatever, because sometimes some agencies will say, that is 13.37. And I look at 13.37 and I ask myself, is it a trade secret? Is it security data? What is it? And in those situations, again, I know how to do the act. I know how to go back, but a lot of people don't. And so if you're looking for the actual implementation of a concept that I've believed for my many times here over decades, if you're going to use the tool of the Data Practices Act, that's an actual implementation of, by, and for the people, which I have intentionally believed in with no pay, and that I've tried to share with many people. So what this bill does is create something to where an individual can get a little bit more data of why they're being denied data that they're entitled to implement that of, by, and for the people, to keep a government accountable and transparent to us, the governed.
Thank you. Any member comments? All right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hugh.
Thank you. I believe I have one other testifier, and I'm...
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Vanderling.
Okay, very good.
Thank
Please
you.
Come forward.
Thank you.
Just if you plan to testify on this bill, could you raise your hand if there's any other testifiers? Okay. We'll get to you after Mr. Gimberling then. And we have about 6 minutes left before the Rules Committee converges upon us. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
You bet. Madam Chair, Don Gimberling from the Coalition on Government Information. I just want to second what Mr. Neumeister told you. At some point, and I was trying to remember when it was done, as the data practices that grew and people were denied access, you added to the act the provision that requires government to cite the section of statute that allows denial of access. And I think the example that Rich gave
the Stingray and other technology. Part of what happens if you're trying to decide whether or not you want to challenge what the government has said about a statutory section, the basis for it, if you look at 1337 and you apply it in an equipment context, there are tests as to whether or not something is actually a trade secret. It's in the definition. There's tests as to whether or not something is security information. It's also part of the definition. And knowing which one it is may determine whether or not you want to take on the government and challenge what they're saying, either administratively or in court. But if you have too many choices, then it limits your choices. So clarifying what exactly, what part of the Data Practices Act is being relied on to deny public access, I think it is an important public policy objective. Representative Pugh has already indicated there is an issue that came up as this was discussed, and she's got an amendment, which you, I know you can't hear under your rules, which we think fixes it, and we support that amendment. So.
Thank you very much. Next testifier. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Fiona Riven. I'm a senior staff attorney at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Prior to working at the DNR, I worked at the Attorney General's office, and I also clerked for a judge in Hennepin County District Court, and I saw numerous felony cases involving felonies for committed for the benefit of a gang, involving juvenile victims and witnesses, and also criminal sexual conduct cases involving minors, and it's with this background in mind that I'm making these comments on the proposed bill. And I know you don't have the amendment before you, but those were the concerns that the lens that was raised. And
so I don't mean to interrupt you, but the amendment would fix your concerns then?
It would fix some of the concerns. There are other provisions that involve protected identities. For example, 1343, I believe it's subdivision 5, refers to personnel data involving undercover officers. So the same, you would have, and undercover officers are protected, their identities are protected under 1382. I believe there may also be other statutory provisions in 609 and in 626 involving mandatory reporters and potentially criminal victims and witnesses involving certain crimes. And I don't know those off the, I just wanted to highlight the issue.
Okay.
But that is the concern. The concern that the DNR has is you don't want, often data requesters may already have a name, and if you have to identify why you're not providing the data, you are then providing contextual clues as to, so you could inadvertently be outing somebody as a minor victim or as a witness or as a government informant or as an undercover officer, and that's the only concern that we wanted to raise.
Great. Well, thank you for raising those, and I know Representative Pugh is open to, don't want to speak for her, but I think she's open to working on language that would alleviate your concerns. And the bill is being laid over, and so if it comes back as part of an omnibus bill, we'll have an amendment ready to offer at that point. And so please feel free to circle around with
Representative. Thank you very much. We appreciate the attention to this issue.
Thank you very much. Any other member questions? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify? Seeing none. Representative Pugh renews her motion that House File 1544 be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, members, we are adjourned.